Up front next, as we await Chris Christie's formal announcement that he's running for president, which we'll be bringing to you, we have breaking news right now in the Trump investigation. Mark Meadows is testifying. Trump's former chief of staff has now testified, we understand, before a federal grand jury investigating Trump. We are learning the special counsel is now using a grand jury in Florida as well. We've got a lot of details for you tonight, breaking. And disaster in Ukraine, now a dangerous blame game of who is behind the destruction of a crucial dam. The breach unleashing deadly floodwaters and now threatening the largest nuclear power plant in Europe. Plus, the PGA Tour sells out to the Saudis. Is professional soccer about to be next? Let's go out front. And good evening. I'm Erin Burnett. Out front tonight, the breaking news. Trump's former chief of staff testifying. CNN confirming that Mark Meadows has testified before a federal grand jury investigating Trump. Meadows is a key figure in the two investigations related to the former president. The probe into Trump's efforts to cling to power and to overturn the 2020 election results, and the investigation into Trump's handling of classified documents. Now, you may remember, according to the January 6th committee, Meadows was helping to lay the groundwork for Trump's big lie. He received this text message from a lawmaker on November 4th, the day after the election, saying, here's an aggressive strategy. Why can't the states of Georgia, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania and other R-controlled state houses declare this is BS? And then the explanation, where conflicts and election not called that night. And just send their own electors to vote and have it go to the SCOTUS, the Supreme Court. Well, you know, it's interesting that was sent, right, because so much of that plan actually did go into motion. And Meadows was there with Trump through all of this. He knows so much when it comes to materials seized at Mar-a-Lago. He was with Trump in the final days of his presidency. He was also formally appointed by Trump to oversee presidential records. So on every front, from January 6th to the efforts to overturn the election to the classified documents, he is front and center. And this major development comes as we are learning the special counsel is now using another grand jury based in Florida as part of its investigation into Trump's handling of classified documents. The Florida grand jury has heard testimony from multiple witnesses. And according to the New York Times, the grand jury in Washington appears to have actually stopped hearing witness testimony. So this is a significant development. Now you've got all this going on in Florida. What does it mean? Well, we understand that testimony, according to the New York Times, includes 20 members of Trump's Secret Service security detail in that Florida grand jury testifying. 20. I mean, 20 people. We didn't know about any of them yesterday. So much to get to tonight as all signs point to the special counsel's investigation into the classified documents portion of this at least wrapping up. Evan Perez and Kristen Holmes are both standing by. They have new reporting here. So, Kristen, I want to start with you. You obviously have the significant breaking news on Mark Meadows. What do you understand happened and what did Mark Meadows do as he testified before the federal grand jury?
Well, Erin, look, this has been a big question mark for months. We knew that Meadows was ordered to testify after a judge threw out Trump's saying that there was executive privilege, but how he was going to do it, when he was going to do it, all remained shrouded in mystery. And as you said, he is a critical witness here due to the uniqueness of his position. He was Trump's chief of staff, meaning that he had proximity to Trump, he had access to high-level conversations, as well as a unique knowledge of his well-being, his mental state, his actions, both on January 6th, leading up to January 6th, as well as when he left office in January of 2021. This is a position that everyone wanted to know what he was going to say and when it was that he was going to testify. And there has been very little insight. I talked to a number of lawyers close to Trump's legal team who said they had no idea what Mark Meadows' level of cooperation was in this investigation, in these investigations. Because as we said, we do not know which grand jury or if it was both he testified in front of. But what we do know is that he would be a critical witness and is considered a critical witness to both of them. So it is very interesting position that we find ourselves in. And again, I cannot tell you, we did a long, deep dive into Mark Meadows just 2 weeks ago about what he has been doing. And the Trump team was largely unaware. And that led to a lot of speculation about cooperation, a lot of questions about what his testimony might actually look like. And he himself is not in touch with the former president. So these are all things to take into consideration when you realize just how important his testimony is and the fact that he's already appeared before that grand jury.
All right, Kristen, thank you very much. Breaking the significant details, let's go to our senior justice correspondent, Evan Perez. So, Evan, you know, Kristen's talking about Mark Meadows testifying. Right. What are you learning? I mean, these are major developments that you're learning about in the grand jury in Florida. I mean, a grand jury that, you know, frankly, until recently, no one even knew was there. Now you're talking about possibly 20 Secret Service agents, maybe more. I mean, what does all of this mean and what do you know?
Right. The last time, Aaron, that we knew that the special counsel or that the investigators in this investigation had gone to a court in Florida was to approve the search warrant at Mar-a-Lago. And so the fact that they've gone back there and they've gone back there recently for a number of witnesses, sources are telling Caitlin Collins that there's a witness, we know of a witness that's going in as soon as tomorrow in Miami. That's the Southern District of Florida. And that there's another witness, at least, who is also scheduled to come in after that person. So it's not clear exactly why the prosecutors have chosen to start using this grand jury after spending months using the grand juries here in Washington. We know that they've had a grand jury that has been hearing testimony on the Mar-a-Lago documents. That grand jury here in Washington hasn't met since about this time last month. And so it's certainly a very dramatic turn of events for them to be bringing witnesses to hear to provide testimony rather before a grand jury down in Miami. Now, a couple of reasons could occur to us for why this could be, and one of them could be that simply they have perhaps someone who they want to charge who is accused or they believe committed a crime in that jurisdiction, and they can't bring it here in Washington. So that might be one reason, perhaps somebody below the level of Donald Trump, who may have, they believe, committed a crime down there. And so that's the reason why they want to bring those witnesses in that jurisdiction. Again, these are all of the questions that we have that we hope Jack Smith is going to be able to provide some answers to in the coming days and weeks.
All right. Thank you very much. Jack Smith, of course, the special counsel. And let's go now to the former Trump White House lawyer, Ty Cobb. So, Ty, you have been saying for a long time in all the conversations we've had that you believe that Meadows is cooperating. Now we know he's appeared before the grand jury. What do you say tonight?
So I believe that he testified shortly after the judge issued the order in March rejecting Trump's claims of executive privilege. But I also believe that it's possible he's testified more than once, given the vast knowledge that he has, as you highlighted in your introduction. The process throughout has been one where there was a lot of news early on about Meadows, you know, his cooperation with January 6th, the contempt referral. But when Justice abandoned the contempt referral, that was an indication that there was a possibility that Meadows had initiated cooperation. And certainly the information that you have today, again, suggests that he's cooperating. It is conceivable that he's being forced to testify and only given qualified immunity. I doubt that's the case. I believe that Meadows has been given full immunity and has a deal with the Justice Department. And that will be very helpful in terms of debunking many of the changing stories that we've heard out of the White House about what happened in those important hours as people tried to prevent democracy from proceeding as it is supposed to post-election.
Yeah, I mean, when you talk about full immunity, that's obviously hugely significant. And if he's given that, I mean, it would seem that it would make sense that he would have answered questions in both. Obviously, classified documents, as I said, he was in charge of that, so that makes sense. But in terms of January 6th and what those charges actually will be, he's absolutely central to that.
No, that's absolutely true. And you know, there are several options still available to Jack Smith. I think the most compelling option is to indict the obstruction case and use the evidence of with regard to the possession of the documents as motive evidence, so you don't have the burden of charging that. And there's also the possibility of charging the January 6th case or using Meadows' testimony to flesh out a report on that.
All right, Ty, thank you very much. I appreciate your perspective on these breaking developments tonight. And let's go now to Ryan Goodman, former special counsel at the Defense Department, along with Karen Friedman-Agnifilo, the former chief assistant district attorney of the Manhattan DA's office. Thanks to both. So, Ryan, we obviously don't know exactly what he said. You heard Ty believe that he's got full, would have been given full immunity and therefore would have chosen to answer questions. How significant do you think this development is?
I think it's hugely significant. We can just recall that there was one of the staffers to the January 6th committee on CNN, Dender Riedelman, said that Meadows was the MVP because he provided them the playbook for the efforts to overturn the January 6th, the efforts of January 6th and to overturn the 2020 election. That's just Meadows' text. So then he stopped cooperating. Now, if he's fully cooperating with the Justice Department and providing testimony, he has a wealth of information, I'd say the keys to the kingdom, on the efforts to overturn the 2020 election, what Ty Cobb just talked about. He was key with the false slate of electors. He, according to Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony, he accumulated charts of all of the electors. Yep. He had multiple dozens of meetings and phone calls about it. So he's running point for President Trump in that instance. And then he's also central to the efforts to use the Justice Department to try to overturn the election in Georgia and elsewhere.
Now, Karen, do you think that, you know, and again, we're going under certain assumptions of things we don't yet know, you know, if he had full immunity and he really did answer all the questions, which we don't yet know the answer to. Do you think this is news to Trump tonight?
I think so. You know, as we all know, grand jury proceedings are secret by its very nature. So we are doing the best we can by reading the tea leaves to try to figure it out. But, you know, it's been very clear that Trump did not know what was happening, that he's gone very quiet to the Trump team. And so I think this really shows that he has testified. I would go a little bit further than even what Ryan is saying. You know, his lawyer, Mr. Twilliger, made a statement today about Meadows' testimony that without commenting on whether or not he testified, he's maintained committed to tell the truth where he has a legal obligation. To me, that suggests that he testified rather than invoking the Fifth. So if he's in there giving testimony, telling the truth where he has a legal obligation, and as Ryan says, that he has the keys to the kingdom, I think there's no doubt that there will be charges forthcoming in the January 6th case in particular, because that is where Meadows, I think, is key.
Right. I mean, Ryan, I think a lot of the discussion had been that it may be hard to get through those charges without him. But if you had him, and you presume Ty Cobb is maybe right, that he testified more than one, right, that he really did give you those keys to the kingdom. Again, we don't fully know that yet. But if so, how does that change your view on the potential slate of charges related to January 6th?
I think it really ratchets up the likelihood that there will be charges against Donald Trump for January 6th, and especially the false slate of electors, which we know is one of the most robust parts of the investigation. And there have to have been court approval of the Justice Department's criminal theory of the case, because they have approved search warrants in that case. And why would they give Meadows immunity? They would give him immunity because he could give them access to the star suspect. That's the reason that you would give somebody immunity who otherwise has a lot of criminal jeopardy on his own.
Right.
That's the deal. And so that's why it's enormously significant if he's cooperating.
All right. So, Karen, other things that we're finding out here at Evan's reporting, right? We know that the D.C. grand jury hasn't really seen activity in a month, but now we're finding a whole lot more about the second grand jury in Miami, that they've heard from multiple witnesses, expected to hear from at least two more. But, you know, we don't fully even know. So what do you think this means?
So if you recall, there are different venues where the Mar-a-Lago documents case could be brought, right? The documents were taken from Washington, D.C., but they were possessed and held in Florida. And any obstruction or, you know, the charges that would come from him holding on to the documents and moving the documents before the search and moving them back after the search, all of that happened in Florida. So this could be as big as the fact that Jack Smith may have decided that Florida is the proper venue for all of it. Mm-hmm. It could mean as something as small as, you know, there's a witness that maybe testified and lied to the FBI and they're going to charge him with lying, you know, lying. And that's just one small bit player. Yeah. It could be something in between. It could be certain people will be charged in one location. Others will be charged in the other. Certain charges will go to one, go to the other. Mm-hmm. It's unclear, but also don't forget, in the federal grand juries, you can they can put hearsay in to the grand jury. So it could also just be for convenience sake. They're letting all the Florida people testify in Florida, and then they pick up those transcripts and an FBI agent goes and reads it to Washington in their grand jury. So we don't know a lot, but there are lots of options there.
Right. Which and that is something I think important, because it's probably something many people certainly didn't realize right until you laid out that possibility. I mean, Ryan, I want to mention again those 20 members of Trump's Secret Service detail. They testified before the D.C.-based grand jury. I misspoke earlier. I said it was the Miami. It was D.C. But that grand jury in D.C., we understand, has no known activity in about a month. What does all that say?
It strongly suggests that that part of the case is closed and they're finished, and that the next step would be, in all likelihood, based on the evidence that we have to read the tea leaves, that Jack Smith would go to Attorney General Garland, recommend an indictment so that he would then return to the grand jury to propose an indictment. And what would be the final step before that? Meeting and allowing a meeting to take place with Trump's attorneys to give them that final opportunity to try to say why they should not indict their client. And then we have also the evidence from Trump himself on Truth Social strongly indicating that he sees an indictment coming after the meeting with his lawyers and the Justice Department.
Right, which, of course, just occurred. So, Karen, you know, one other crucial thing happened here. You know, person who knows a lot about this, Trump's own handpicked former attorney general, right? Bill Barr spoke out today. Earlier today, he didn't just say an indictment was imminent. He also came out and defended the DOJ against what, obviously, we have all heard has been an onslaught of attacks from Trump's entire team. Here's Bill Barr.
I suspect it's near. I've said for a while that I think this is the most dangerous legal risk facing the former president. And if I had to bet, I would bet that it's near. I think if based on the facts, as the facts come out, I think over time people will see that this is not a case of the Department of Justice, you know, conducting a witch hunt.
You know, it's important to hear him say that, Karen. Why do you think he is saying that publicly right now? Do you think he has some insight into an indictment?
He may have some insight. I think Smith and his team are really keeping things close to the vest. So it could also just be he was the leader of the team. You know, he's leader of the Justice Department. He knows what these things mean and the cadence of things. And as Ryan was saying, this looks like it's nearing the end. He knows all of that. And so it's very easy for someone who is an insider and who recently ran that agency to be able to give pretty good information. So I think it might be a combination of both.
All right. Well, thank you both very much. I appreciate it. And next, our breaking news continues this hour. Former Republican Governor Chris Christie announcing he is running for president, speaking right now to voters in New Hampshire. And the former prosecutor has a lot to say about Trump's legal problems, plus a major dam in Ukraine destroyed. And now at what we've seen happen, billions of gallons of water, an entire region of Ukraine now suddenly underwater. President's advisor telling Out Front why he believes the Russians are to blame. We'll go to Ukraine for that. And the PGA Tour selling out to Saudi Arabia. But they're far from the only professional sport that the Saudis have their sights on. Breaking news, the former New Jersey governor, Chris Christie, speaking now to voters in New Hampshire after announcing just moments ago that he is running for president again.
And that's why I came back to New Hampshire to tell all of you that I intend to seek the Republican nomination for President of the United States in 2024, and I want your support.
Christie is a former federal prosecutor, and he is building a political case against former President Trump, whose legal problems, of course, are mounting tonight. And Christie has also made a legal case as well. He's a former prosecutor. But as we told you at the top of the show, Trump's former chief of staff, Mark Meadows, testified before a grand jury investigating Trump. And that's also a major development tonight. So in his first campaign event as a presidential candidate, Chris Christie is wasting absolutely no time doing, frankly, what the other people running on the presidential side and the Republican side have been loath to do. He was quick to go directly after Trump.
Beware of the leader in this country who you have handed leadership to, who has never made a mistake, who has never done anything wrong, who when something goes wrong, it's always someone else's fault, and who has never lost. The person I am talking about who is obsessed with the mirror, who never admits a mistake, who never admits a fault, and who always finds someone else and something else to blame for whatever goes wrong, but finds every reason to take credit for anything that goes right, is Donald Trump.
Omar Jimenez is out front. He is at Christie's rally in Manchester, New Hampshire. So, Omar, how much has Christie focused on Trump tonight?
That's right, Aaron, and I will say I'm talking softly because he's right behind me as he continues this, but he, amid all of the news around Trump world, Christie talked about there being leaders right now who try to tell you that character doesn't matter. And he, of course, was not shy in mentioning Donald Trump's name over the course of this. He even went so far as to say, for Harry Potter fans, that Donald Trump has been treated like Voldemort over the course of this campaign season, someone as he who must not be named, and that he is not going to play those games. He also focused on one key metaphor before he formally announced for president, saying that we have a choice as a country to be big or be small, to get bigger or get smaller. And he went through time after time in history, going back to the Revolutionary War, about moments in time where he felt the country chose not to be small. And he feels we're at a similar moment right now. Take a listen to some more of what Christie said about Donald Trump, who is seen as the front runner, even at these early stages. And it shows how not shy Christie has been in going after the former president.
Donald Trump made us smaller by dividing us even further and pitting one group against another, different groups pitted against different groups every day.
And obviously, he has his work cut out for him. He has not been at the top of recent polls as a crowded GOP field has grown. But the energy in the room tonight is, I think, the energy he wants to channel into a campaign where, of course, he intends to take on the former president head on.
All right, Omar, thank you very much. Live in Manchester. I want to go now to Bob Vanderplaats, CEO of the Family Leader and a top conservative, evangelical and influential voice in Iowa politics. Bob, let me just start. I want to talk to you about the obviously these crucial issues with Trump and these legal issues that are mounting tonight. But Chris Christie taking him on directly, whereas others in the field have chosen not to do so. What do you think of that? Is that the right way to go with Republican-based voters?
Well, when I listen to Governor Christie announce his campaign for president, I think, you know, some people are called to run for president and they're running for president. I think Governor Christie, he feels called to stop Donald Trump. And his whole message was on, how do you stop Donald Trump? And he's just going to build a case, as you mentioned earlier, as a former prosecutor, against Donald Trump. So if you're Ron DeSantis or Mike Pence or Nikki Haley or Tim Scott in the race, you're probably thinking, I'm kind of glad Chris Christie's going in there because I want to be the alternative to Trump. But I don't believe for a second Christie is running for president to be president. I think he's running for president to stop Donald Trump.
That's interesting that you think that. So do you, I mean.
Well, he has no support there. I mean, you see the polls. He's not here in Iowa. He announces in New Hampshire. And New Hampshire is where he took down Marco Rubio. Right. New Hampshire with the 80 people in the room who's got the energy, I guess, in the room. But he's doing one thing. That is, I'm going to go after the former president. Now, if that's what he feels called to do, let him go.
Well, let me just talk to you about this, because I know you have voiced your own concerns about the Trump situation, and he's got now even more legal issues, none of which thus far have done absolutely anything to dent his leadership. In fact, they have only increased his lead over his closest rival, Ron DeSantis, in early polling, right? That's what's happened. Now, you're going to get a bunch of indictments possibly from the DOJ. Maybe that'll change. Do you think it changes? Is this ever going to be a problem for Trump?
Well, first of all, I don't trust the early polling at all. And you and I have been around this long enough, Aaron, to understand. In 2008, if the polling was right, you'd have Rudolph Giuliani. 2012, you would have had Rick Perry. 2016 would have been Scott Walker or maybe Jeb Bush. So I'm not so concerned about the early polling. What we are seeing in Iowa, though, is he cancels a rally that was going to be a large rally. He's now holding events when he does come to Iowa in very small venues. I believe there's an appetite for somebody that's an alternative to Trump. I think a lot of people are very thankful for what the former president did in his administration. But now they believe it's time to turn the page so we can win in 2024.
All right. So let me ask you, though, because when I and you talk about evangelical voters, so crucial in the GOP base. OK, a recent Fox News poll has 59% of white evangelicals, Bob, want Trump to be the Republican nominee. No one else even comes close. Now, I know you don't trust early pollings, but this is a group that you know a lot about, a lot about. So what do you say to that? What accounts for that consistent support?
Well, I believe that poll is probably indicative of what the Trump administration did. We know the former president's a transactional leader. You do right by me, I do right by you. Evangelicals helped get him into the presidency. So he moves the embassy to Jerusalem. He appoints three Supreme Court justices. He defends religious liberty, stands up for the sanctity of human life. There's a lot of things he did that people are going to applaud him for. And I think that poll's indicative of that. But the campaign's going to be different. And Trump's biggest hurdle is, can he win in 2024? Because evangelicals are very wise. They know 24 is not 2016. And maybe too much of the country has made up their mind on the former president. That's his biggest hurdle. That's what he's got to sell evangelicals on to close the sale.
All right. Thank you very much, Bob. I appreciate your time, as always. And you heard Chris Christie, obviously, just announcing tonight, tomorrow on CNN, don't miss a town hall with Mike Pence. Dana Bash will be moderating that. That is at 9 o'clock tomorrow night. Out front next, new video of a building being swept away after a crucial dam in Ukraine is destroyed. And now the largest nuclear power plant in Europe tonight is in danger. So who was behind this breach? We're live in Ukraine. Plus, these are live pictures of New York, not Mars. And smoke from the wildfires in Canada are now completely blanketing New York City, air quality reaching hazardous levels. Tonight, growing questions about the destruction of a critical dam along the front lines in Ukraine. We've got new video into Out Front. This is a building being swept away as the floodwaters just completely race across the terrain. Now, Ukraine had warned that if the dam ever was compromised, nearly 5 billion gallons of water would flood southern Ukraine. That's equivalent to the Great Salt Lake in Utah. And one Ukrainian officer tells CNN that his men watched Russian soldiers actually being swept away. So let me just show you where this dam is to give you a sense of it, right? You're along the crucial Dnipro River and right along the front line of this war. Russia has been control of one side, Ukraine on the other. Nearby, of course, is Europe's largest nuclear power plant in Zaporizhia, which relies on the water in this reservoir to cool its reactors. And Ukraine is blaming Russia tonight.
This deliberate destruction of the dam and other HPP facilities by the Russian occupiers is an environmental bomb of mass destruction. For the sake of their own security, the world should now show that Russia will not get away with such terror.
Russia denies it, blaming Ukraine. The United States is still investigating, it says, according to intelligence. Earlier, Zelensky's senior advisor spoke to Out Front, and he said the attack was to stop Ukraine's highly anticipated counteroffensive, right, which had been the whole goal was to cross the Dnipro River. The United States, of course, believes that counteroffensive has begun. Here's Zelensky's advisor, Mikhail Podolyak.
In blowing up the Kakhovka hydropower plant, Russia is trying to suspend our counteroffensive, in this case, in the southern direction.
Fred Plykin is Out Front to begin our coverage in the flooded region.
Masses of water gushing from the gaping hole in the destroyed Novokarkhovka Dam in Russian-controlled territory here in South Ukraine. Massive flooding quickly inundating villages on both shores of the mighty Dnipro River, impacting areas controlled by Ukrainians and by the Russians.
As you can see, there's a massive rescue effort going on here. The local authorities are using boats and also heavy trucks to get as many people out of the zone as they can.
65-year-old Nadezhda Chernyshova was stranded in her home with her cat Sonia for hours, fearing for her life. Now I'm not scared, she says, but there it was scary. Why, I ask? Because of the water. The water came and you don't know from where it comes and where it will go. The authorities here say they've evacuated hundreds of people throughout the day. At times under Russian fire, the head of Kherson's military administration tells me. We have the water, he says. Mines are floating to here, and this district is constantly being shelled. Two policemen were injured while evacuating people. Kyiv blames Moscow for allegedly blowing up the dam, an angry Ukrainian president saying the Russians are trying to derail Ukraine's current battlefield gains.
It's unreal.
It was mined by the Russian occupiers, he says, and they blew it up. This once again demonstrates the cynicism with which Russia treats the people whose land it has captured. The destruction of the dam comes as Ukrainian forces have been making gains on the battlefield, what some believe may be the early stages of Kyiv's long-awaited counter-offensive, even though the Ukrainians haven't confirmed that. Russia's army denies blowing up the dam, instead blaming the Ukrainians. Aiming to prevent the offensive operations by the Russian army on this section of the front line, the Kyiv regime committed an act of sabotage, or rather a terrorist act, the defense minister said. While the floodwaters are affecting ever more areas around Kherson, upstream, the levels are critically low, around the Zaporizhia power plant, the biggest in all of Europe, which relies on a pond connected to the river for cooling. The International Atomic Energy Agency says so far there's no danger, but that could change.
It is therefore vital that this cooling pond remains intact. Nothing must be done to potentially undermine its integrity.
So there you can see, Aaron, an extremely difficult and dangerous situation down here in the south of Ukraine with that massive river just continuously flooding. And I think there's two things that our viewers really need to be aware of. On the one hand, those floodwaters are rising extremely quickly. We were on the ground there today, and just in a short period of time, that water went up considerably. And the other thing is, the Russian army is very close to this place. There is constant shelling going on here. In fact, as I'm speaking to you right now, I'm hearing those thuds in the distance. And this comes as Ukrainian officials are saying they believe that more than 1,000 houses are underwater just in the Ukrainian-controlled territories of the flood zone. Aaron.
Fred, thank you very much. Live in Kherson, in the midst of that flooding, you could hear him saying, you hear the thuds of the shelling in the distance. Inna Sovsun joins me now, a member of Ukraine's parliament. And Inna, I appreciate your time. Obviously, I know it is very late where you are, or very early in the morning. Does Ukraine have proof that Russia is responsible for the dam explosion and break?
Well, of course, we cannot provide a very specific proof because the dam has been under Russian control for months now. And I think that is the single proof that we can provide, is that the dam is under Russian control. The explosion came from within, so it had to be done by someone who had control over the territory. And that those are the Russians who had the control over the territory. They were the only ones who could have actually done this. So this is as much evidence as we can provide, given that we do not have access to this territory now, and we didn't have access to this territory yesterday to set up such an explosion.
All right, well, it's crucial that everyone understand that. I think these are important facts. A senior NATO official, Inna, said today that U.S. and Western officials do see signs that the long-awaited counteroffensive against Russia is beginning. Obviously, when you're talking about 5 billion gallons of water now flooding a region, does the dam break, do you think, have any impact on the counteroffensive plans?
Well, it is definitely distracting our military, at least, right? People who could have been engaged in the counteroffensive efforts are now doing evacuation, are now helping with the people, with the humanitarian aid, and so on and so forth. So that is the least effect that it can have on the counteroffensive. Now, as you know very well, as of right now, the detailed plan of the counteroffensive is unclear, so we cannot confirm or deny that this could have been the direction of the counteroffensive. But the fact that it definitely diverts efforts from the military side to the humanitarian aid, which is also being provided by the military personnel on the south over there right now, that is definitely can be confirmed. So yes, I can say that it is part of the plan to suspend the counteroffensive. Whether it will be successful or not, I think the coming days will show.
All right. And of course, the world is watching. Inna, thank you so very much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
And next, the PGA Tour, selling out to Saudi Arabia. After a year of boldly and defiantly refusing to join forces, saying it would be taking Saudi blood money. Plus, tense testimony from Prince Harry, who is accusing the British press of having blood on their hands. Tonight, selling out to Saudi Arabia, the sports world in shock after the PGA Tour announced it was merging with the controversial Saudi-backed LIV Golf League, a deal that reportedly stunned most members of the PGA Tour. You remember the PGA Tour was locked in a bitter battle with LIV, which had offered stars like Phil Mickelson multi-million dollar deals to join. Right? Tiger Woods said no way, wasn't right. It was just under a year ago that the commissioner of the PGA Tour himself said this to players contemplating joining the Saudi League.
I think you'd have to be living under a rock to not know that there are significant implications. And as it relates to the families of 9/11, I have two families that are close to me that lost loved ones. And so my heart goes out to them. And I would ask, you know, any player that has left or any player that would ever consider leaving, have you ever had to apologize for being a member of the PGA Tour?
Right. And then there was, of course, the bone saw incident. I mean, look, it was really different today. What we heard from Mr. Monahan today was, well, extremely different about teeing up the Saudis.
What we're talking about today is coming together to unify the game of golf. The game of golf is better for what we've done here today.
Okay. So, sure. But I just want to be clear that he is not alone in changing his tune on the Saudis, right? Actually, just one of many, sort of got to the point where maybe he just got a cave, because it goes way beyond the sports world. Then-candidate Joe Biden, remember, he vowed to make Saudi Arabia pariah, his word, over the murder of the Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi, the bone saw incident, a murder that U.S. intelligence concluded that the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, approved. As president, though, Biden met with MBS, the crown prince, in an attempt to get the Saudis to boost oil production. And guess what? The Saudis said, sorry. Out front now, Harry Enten, our numbers whiz. I mean, Harry, this is just a situation here where money talks, mm-hmm. Okay? Money talks, and morality can get in the way of it, and for many, money ends up winning. So you found out how Americans view Saudi Arabia is an issue, an incredibly rare issue, where you have bipartisan agreement.
We have bipartisan agreement. Look, the percentage of Americans who have an unfavorable view of Saudi Arabia well into the 60s. And more than that, what you see is Democrats, 73% have an unfavorable view of Saudi Arabia. Republicans, 67%. And I will note on the time trend, views on Saudi Arabia have been coming negative, more negative, negative, and negative.
Which is amazing, because you're saying over the past year, when you had, you know, from political and business circles, negative views, they're changing their tune, but the public isn't, which
Correct.
Is fascinating. So how do Americans see Saudi?
Yes. So I think one of the key things to point out, you know, if you look at how Americans view the relationship between the USA and Saudi Arabia, very few see this as an ally-on-ally relationship, right? Just 3% say we're an ally with them. But look at that. 40% say we're a necessary partner. Mm-hmm. So I think this sort of gets at what's going on, right?
Certainly with Joe Biden, it does. Yeah.
Exactly right. We don't necessarily like Saudi Arabia, but we understand that there needs to be a relationship with them. And that is, I think, what you saw with Joe Biden. And I think that's also what you're seeing with the PGA Tour saying, you know what, actually, we're going to team up with the folks over in Saudi Arabia.
So to be clear, because obviously they are front and center today and it's a big flip flop, but they're not the only ones, not the only sport doing this.
They are not the only sport doing it. So I think, you know, this is all a play by Saudi Arabia to try and sort of ingratiate themselves into the sports world. So they did it, obviously, with golf, but they're also doing it with soccer. There are a number of big soccer stars who are going over to Saudi Arabia. Ronaldo is one of them. You see another one on there.
Yeah, Benzema. He has an apartment over there, yeah.
Exactly. Look at these amount of money that Saudi Arabia has given to these folks. 100 million plus per year estimated. 200 million plus per year estimated. This is per year to get these folks to play. So Saudi Arabia believes money talks, and apparently money does talk.
It may. It's interesting. I was just over in the region, you know, and Ronaldo's all over all the tabloids. And I asked myself, I wonder how long he'll actually live there. But that's the thing, right? It would pass the payday. And that's the big question for Saudi Arabia.
We'll see.
All right. Thanks, Harry.
Thank you.
And out front next, Prince Harry taking the stand in an historic case. And he took on the British tabloids, who he accuses of hacking his phone. Plus these live pictures out of New York, otherworldly and deeply disturbing. This is the air tonight. It is not fog. It is air quality. It is a haze, a smoke, and we'll tell you why. A Tonight, tense testimony from Prince Harry. His years-long battle with the British press coming to a head in a London courtroom today. The Duke of Sussex suing a British tabloid publisher, accusing them of hacking his phones to get private information that they later printed. Harry telling the court that British journalism has hit, quote, rock bottom. Nada Bashir is out front.
A highly anticipated moment in a carefully watched legal battle. Prince Harry becoming the first senior British royal to testify in court in over a century. The Duke of Sussex is among dozens of claimants suing British tabloid publisher Mirror Group Newspapers over allegations their journalists used unlawful means, including phone hacking, to obtain private information between 1991 and 2011. Prince Harry's witness statement goes into extraordinary detail about how MGN's intrusive tactics impacted his personal life, saying how much more blood will stain their typing fingers before someone can put a stop to this madness. Meanwhile, the Duke's lawyer says newspaper articles like these show telltale signs of illegal information gathering. From the intimate details of private conversations shared with his brother William, the Prince of Wales, Harry telling the court that MGN's journalists planted seeds of distrust between the two, to the ups and downs of his relationship with former long-term girlfriend Chelsea Davy, intrusions which he says led to huge amounts of paranoia and even bouts of depression. With MGN's tabloids labelling him the Playboy Prince, thicko and dropout in his youth. But Prince Harry's testimony also details alleged evidence of payments made to private investigators tasked with gleaning personal information about his mother, the late Princess Diana. A recent revelation which he said made him feel physically sick. MGN has contested most of the allegations put forward in the Duke of Sussex's claim, arguing that there is simply not enough evidence to prove that his phone was hacked. The trial comes on the heels of an incident last month where Prince Harry and his wife, Meghan, the Duchess of Sussex, were pursued by paparazzi for 2 hours after an event in New York. The couple describing the chase as near catastrophic, though the severity of the incident has since been called into question. Despite a fierce round of questions today in court, Prince Harry is not backing down.
It's pretty clear how personal this is for him. He blames the tabloid media in the UK for the death of his mother, for the destruction of his relationships, and for his poor mental health. He says that his family is forced to flee the UK because of them.
Nada Bashir, CNN, London.
And coming up on AC360, the man who took down one of America's most notorious spies, Robert Hansen, who died in prison yesterday, joins Anderson tonight. You'll hear that story at 8. And next, live pictures of New York suffering under a blanket of dangerous smoke from thousands of miles away. Officials urging people to stay inside. And finally tonight, this is what it looks like in New York City right now. Orange, hazardous, smoky cloud descending upon the city. So bad that New York temporarily topped the list of having the world's worst air pollution, the world's worst. And it's all because of more than 150 wildfires that are actually burning across Quebec, Canada. Officials today warning the dangerous conditions can result in shortness of breath, worsen asthma, heart disease. And the smoke isn't obviously just affecting New York. More than 40 million people across the Northeast, Midwest, and Mid-Atlantic are under air quality alerts. Thanks so much for joining us. It's time now for AC360 with Anderson Cooper.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.